Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland podcast. My name is Fraser, and it's been an absolute privilege to journey through the annals of Scottish history with you, shedding light on both the iconic and hidden tales of Scottish history past. In our last episode, we journeyed through the intricate web of Scottish noble families during David I's reign. From the illustrious to the lesser known, each family painted a stroke on the vast canvas of Scotland's medieval period. Their triumphs, tragedies, alliances, and feuds formed the backbone of an era that saw Scotland transform in ways few could have imagined. But as the old adage goes, all good things must come to an end. Today's episode carries a weight of finality as we prepare to bid adieu to David I, a monarch whose very essence seems intertwined with the land he ruled. David was not just a king, he was a revolutionary force. Under his scepter, Scotland witnessed tumultuous wars, unprecedented revolutions, social metaphors, and groundbreaking reforms. We delve deep into his life, reign, and legacy over the span of six riveting episodes. Through victories and defeats, peace and chaos, David's story has been nothing short of epic. Now, I do confess, parting with such a monumental figure isn't easy. The deeper we've delved into David's life, the closer we've felt to the man behind the crown. His complexities, his ambitions, his vulnerabilities, they've given life to centuries-old tales, making them more resonate better in today's world. But as historians, enthusiasts and storytellers, we know that history is a relentless tide, constantly moving forward irrespective of our affections. However, before we proceed, I have a question for all of you. Are you ready to take this last journey with King David I? I can almost feel the mixed emotions through the airwaves, a blend of anticipation and nostalgia. But let me assure you, today's episode is not just a farewell, it's a celebration of a life that shaped the very destiny of Scotland. So, gather your thoughts, perhaps pour yourself a comforting drink, and let's embark on this final voyage, revisiting the life and times of David I, ensuring that even as we move forward, the echoes of his reign continue to inspire and inform us. Well, there we are. Dear listeners, the stage is set. Let's journey together one last time into the world of David I in the 1100s. Let's do a quick recap of David's reign and what we've covered so far. As we know, David's early life in England, he began his story in 1084 amidst the bustling courts of England. Though born a Scot, his youth in England had an indelible mark on him. The English court, a melting pot of cultural exchanges in the 11th century, exposed him to Norman practices, both political and cultural. This, as we'll later see, profoundly influenced his reign and Scotland's transformation. After this, he became Prince of the Cumbrians around the early 1100s. He bore the title that was given to him by his brother. He controlled the lands of southern Scotland and northern England. His tenure as prince was not merely titular, it was a crucible, tempering his leadership and administrative acumen, preparing him for the throne of Scotland. And then in 1124 AD, the winds of change blew across the Scotland Highlands and Lowlands alike. David I, after years of preparation, ascended the Scottish throne. His reign heralded in a new era for Scotland, promising reforms, diplomacy, and expansion. But the journey wasn't a bed of roses. David's early years, particularly around the early to mid-1120s, were marred with civil discord. Several factions, old and new, challenged his authority, including relatives who had a claim to the throne. But with tact and persistence, David quelled these rebellions, ensuring his mandate remained unchallenged. And then between 1124 and 1153, under David's watchful eyes, we know Scotland underwent what historians now term the Davidonian Revolution. We've done so much talking about it, so I won't bore you with what happened. We all know what's happened by now. If not, go see the past few episodes. There was obviously the English War as well and the loss of the Battle of the Standard in August 1138. It was a defining moment in David's military pursuits. Leading his forces against England, he found himself in the battle. The banners of Scotland wavered, but the spirits of the Scots were unwavering and the day ended in a defeat. This loss, though a setback, was a testament to David's relentless ambition for Scotland. And then finally, we know about the church reform following in his mother's footsteps, bringing the entire Scottish church in line with the European model and European Christendom. So this recap sets the stage for today's deep dive into the finale of David I. So let's journey into the fascinating reign and final years of David. In the years following 1150, David I, having been a key architect of the Davidonian Revolution, worked rigorously to consolidate the reforms he had introduced. Towns like Berwick and Edinburgh, which later became significant Scottish hubs, owe their early growth to the policies of this period. Berwick upon Tweed, often simply called Berwick, is strategically situated at the mouth of the River Tweed on the east coast of the British Isles. Let's go into the details of how the town formed and how it's doing in David's reign, since it is a key hub of Scottish power, and we haven't really covered the main towns and cities during this period. This location on the Anglo-Scottish border has historically made it a site of significant military and commercial importance. Berwick's origins can be traced back to the prehistoric times, but by the time the Romans arrived in Britain, it was already a settlement of note. The Romans, recognising its strategic value, likely established a fort or outpost in the region. In the post-Roman period, the area was oscillated between Northumbrian and Scottish control, or shall we say, Kingdom of Picts control, reflecting the broader territorial disputes between the emerging kingdoms of Saxon England and the Kingdom of Alba/Scotland. But by the 12th century, Berwick was well established as a trading town, but it was under David I that it truly began to flourish. David, often recognised for his modernising reforms and urban developments throughout Scotland, understood the commercial potential of Berwick. David encouraged trade by granting the town a royal borough status, which offered traders and residents a range of privileges. This move attracted merchants from various regions, turning Berwick into a bustling trade hub. By the mid-12th century, it was arguably the most prosperous town in Scotland, with the trade connections stretching across England and even into continental Europe. Berwick saw considerable infrastructure development. Roads were improved, making transport easier. New buildings, both commercial and residential, were erected, further enhancing the town's status. But the broader economic policies, which included in the currency reforms and establishment of other boroughs, indirectly boosted Berwick. With a standardised currency and a burgeoning network of Scottish towns, trade became more streamlined, and Berwick as a premier port benefited enormously. But, with it being a strategic position, David also bolstered Berwick's defences, ensuring it could repel potential threats. This dual focus on commerce and defence made the town both wealthy and secure. However, the prosperity of Berwick enjoyed under David I would later make it a flashpoint in the tumultuous relations between England and Scotland. In the centuries following 1150, the town would change hands numerous times and witness several sieges and battles. But as of 1150, Berwick stood as a testament to David I's visionary leadership, a thriving urban centre poised to play a crucial role in the unfolding history of the British Isles. If we switch to Edinburgh now during David's reign, Edinburgh's origins are more ancient. The iconic Edinburgh Castle, which towers over the city, stands on Castle Rock, a site of a human habitation dating back to the Bronze Age. The Romans, during their occupation of Britain, noted a tribe called the Vaudetti in the region, who later established a hill fort on the Castle Rock. But the city's name, Edinburgh, it is believed to have derived from Edin's Borough, named after Edwin of Northumbria, who ruled in the 7th century. Over the centuries, the settlement expanded beyond the fortress. When David assumed the throne in 1124, however, Edinburgh was already a town with significance, as we know where St Margaret of Scotland stayed during Malcolm Canmore's invasion of England, and obviously that's where she passed away from grief, and it's also where Edgar the Elfling helped rescue, shall we say, David and his siblings. Like Berwick, obviously, Edinburgh was granted a royal borough status, which endowed the city with lots of rights and privileges, making trade, commerce, etc. a lot greater in the town. David was often dubbed a saintly king due to his deep piety, found in the Abbey of Holyrood around 1124, which later became Holyrood Palace. This religious institution attracted pilgrims, further boosting the town's prestige and economy. But obviously, as we all know with Edinburgh, David understood the strategic importance when it comes to defences. He strengthened them, this including reinforcing Edinburgh Castle, which stood as both a royal residence and a formidable stronghold. The Castle Rock had obviously seen rudimentary fortifications over its time, but under David, the castle began to take on a more recognised form. The civic structures he built are hard to discern from today due to constructions and later renovations, but records indicate that he invested in the castle's development. We already know about St. Margaret's Chapel, which was built by David in honour of his mother, Queen Margaret, who was obviously later canonised. But there was obviously the strategic importance as well. David ensured it was adequately fortified. The exact scale of the fortifications during his reign isn't entirely clear, but they were formidable, possibly including the walls, the gates, and the defensive towers on the outside. But under David, the castle wasn't just a military fortress, it was a symbol of royal authority and the unity of the Scottish kingdom. By 1150, Edinburgh Castle was one of the most significant fortresses in Scotland, both in terms of its size and symbolic value. Its strategic position atop Castle Rock, combined with the fortifications added during David's reign, made it a near impregnable stronghold. The exact dimensions and layout of the castle at this time are hard to determine due to the subsequent expansions and renovations, as we've said, but it's still clear by the mid-12th century it was a substantial and vital castle in the landscape of Scotland. It is a must visit if you ever come to Edinburgh. The castle still looms over the great capital even to this day. It's great and full of history. But back to the history itself. Obviously, Edinburgh was granted to Norman and Anglo-Norman nobles as well, in turn for introducing new agricultural techniques. This brought prosperity to the surrounding regions and ensured a steady flow of resources into the city. By the end of David I's reign in 1153, Edinburgh was on its way to becoming one of the most principal cities of Scotland. It was a hub of trade, a centre of royal authority, and a beacon of religious devotion. The foundation David laid in 12th century helped Edinburgh grow in prominence and prestige, setting it on a path to eventually become the capital of Scotland and one of the great cities of Europe. From the 1140s onwards, David became deeply in thought about the future of the Scottish crown. The complexities of medieval politics meant that picking a successor wasn't just about family lineage, it was a strategic choice. He sought someone with both vigour to defend Scotland's borders and the sanctity to govern its diverse populace. The untimely death of his son, as we've said in the past few episodes, Prince Henry in 1152, threw a wrench into David's plans. Henry was not just his son, but a well-respected figure, having governed broad swathes of Scotland already. His demise created a vacuum, and the dream of seamless succession now seemed a distant one. Henry's death was a personal tragedy for David, but the king knew he had to rise above his grief for the sake of Scotland. With Henry gone, David's gaze turned towards his grandsons. One of them was called Malcolm. He was born in the 20th of March 1141 and he was around 12 years old. William, who would later be known as William the Lion, was born in 1143 and he was around 10 years old. And then David, who was born in 1144 AD and he was around 9 years old of David's death. There was also daughters including Ada, Margaret and possibly others, but the exact numbers and details of all Henry's children are not thoroughly documented in every historical record. Malcolm, William and David are the most often cited and the most historically significant of Henry's offspring, as we'll later find out in the future episodes. And obviously daughters weren't looked upon in the succession very well, so they were really out of the running from the start. While several of them had potential claims, it was Malcolm, Henry's eldest son, who caught the king's attention. Malcolm was young, barely 10 years old at the time, going on 12 when David would eventually pass away. Ordinarily, choosing such a young heir in the turbulent medieval world would be risky. However, David perhaps saw in Malcolm a reflection of his own youthful ambition. Other potential heirs, like William and David, were also considered, but it seemed that Malcolm's nascent promise as a leader set him apart. The decision to choose Malcolm, who would later be known as Malcolm IV, David's grandson as an heir, can be attributed to a combination of dynastic issues and political circumstance. David's own son Henry predeceased him in 1152, and that famous saying, "No father should have to bury their son," happened. While Henry had left behind three sons, Malcolm being the eldest, naturally the primary choice for succession was the eldest, and the eldest out of Henry's sons was Malcolm. The premature death also placed David in a precarious position. With his own mortality looming, a potential succession crisis, a genuine medieval concern, David needed to ensure a clear line of succession to maintain the stability he worked hard to establish during his reign. Now, historically, young monarchs ascending to thrones during their minority was fraught with challenges. Often, a regency council or a regent would be appointed to govern on behalf of the young king. These regencies sometimes became hotbeds of political intrigue, power struggles, and corruption. Young kings were susceptible to manipulation by ambitious nobles, leading to potential loss of a royal authority and power. Neighbouring states and rulers often viewed a kingdom with a child monarch as an opportunity for conquest or to gain significant concessions. The lack of a mature guiding hand could lead to internal strife, uprisings, and challenges to the throne by other claimants. But despite the potential pitfalls associated with young monarchs, David had several compelling reasons to choose Malcolm. Malcolm represented the continuation of David's bloodline, which was crucial for the legitimacy of the ruling dynasty. In an age where the legitimacy of rulers was paramount, the straightforward lineage from David to Malcolm, even if Malcolm was a minor, provided a clearer claim to the throne than any other alternative candidates. This clarity was essential in minimising potential challenges or dispute. There was also time for Malcolm to be groomed for kingship, learning ropes of governance under the guidance of trusted advisors. And then finally, the one that would be really crucial was the guiding hands of a regent. David could ensure that the trustworthy individuals surrounding Malcolm, such as Donchad of the Mormer of Fife, for instance, was a trusted figure who could play a significant role in Malcolm's early reign and guide him in the correct way. Now, Donchad the First, Mormer of the Fife, was a pivotal figure in David's reign. Donchad the First, often anglicised a Duncan, held the title of Mormer, an ancient Gaelic term that predates the Norman influence. By the time of David I, the term Mormer was transitioned to what we now understand as Earl. Born in the early 1100s, Donchad's exact date of birth remains obscured by history. I think what we'll do is we'll actually call him Duncan going forward, just in case I'm mispronouncing anything. But his connection to David I was complex. He was part of the Scottish noble, especially the precise and familiar relationship between Duncan and King David wasn't established in the historical records, but what we do know is they did have a close association. They appear together in various charters and official documents, a testament to the trust David placed in him. This close bond wasn't merely based on political convenience, but potentially on kinship. Given the era, David I's intricate web of familial ties with numerous Scottish nobles was not unusual. Around the 1130s, during the peak of David's power, Duncan's prominence in the Scottish court was palpable. The 12th century witnessed a burgeoning influence, as we know, of the Norman families in Scotland, a trend that David, having spent time in the English court, was particularly inclined towards. The rise of Norman families in the Scottish hierarchy could have threatened indigenous leaders like Duncan, yet he not only maintained his position, but seemingly flourished. By the mid-century, Duncan had established himself as one of the leading magnates at the Scottish court. His ability to navigate the shifting sands of political alliances, particularly during a time when Norman families were often favoured, is a testament to his political acumen and the depth of his relationship with David. I know we didn't mention him in the last episode, and I'm just realising that now as I'm writing this. I don't know how we missed him. I think it's because when I was looking at this, I got Donchad mixed up with Dunmacalpin, the person who was starting one of the rebellions during David's earlier reign. But regardless, at least we're delving into him now. Duncan was known for his wisdom. He was a man of his times, yet seemed to rise above many of his contemporaries. David's reliance on Duncan, especially in crucial junctures of his reign, underscores the latter's influence and capability. Moreover, the collaboration was not just restricted to political matters. They shared a vision for Scotland, a nation state with a strong centralised monarchy, a reformed church, and a realm that could hold its own against the larger geopolitics of the British Isles. Duncan was not just a passive participant. He actively shaped and helped influence the decisions with David, ensuring that even amidst the growing Norman influence, indigenous Scottish nobility had a voice. In essence, Duncan of Fife stands out not just as a powerful earl, but as a figure who, in partnership with David, played a pivotal role in shaping the destiny of 12th century Scotland. But during the twilight years of David's reign, this question of succession was looming. The untimely death, as we know, of Henry left this vacuum open. Malcolm was a minor and he was only 10 years old. David would only live for another 2 years. So this posed a genuine concern, as youthful kings, as we know, often found themselves in a mist of palace intrigues, if not outright usurpation. So, Enter, right, Duncan, mormer of Fife, in his trusted position in Davis Court, and his experience made him the prime candidate to guide the young Malcolm during his early years as a king. But why was he chosen in the first place? He was a great magnate and he was close to David, but what was his traits? What was his good traits? Well, obviously the vacuum of power was there, so Duncan could definitely fill the vacuum of power, but he was close to the crown as we know. His proximity to David was close. He was a close magnate and helped David in a lot of his decisions during his reign. He helped balance the Norman influence. So if David greatly favoured the Norman nobles, granted them lands and positions of influence, Duncan, being of Gaelic origin, provided a counterbalance to this Norman influence. His appointment would have been seen as a move to appease and unify the different factions within Scotland, and it's actually quite smart with him doing that. He was also a tested military leader. He wasn't just a political figure, he was a seasoned warrior. Appointing him as regent ensured young Malcolm had someone capable of defending the crown against any military threats. And obviously, the sense, as we just mentioned, of continuity. Since Duncan was already there helping David during his reign in the background as one of the leading magnates, it gave a sense of continuity. Duncan's appointment as regent was a pragmatic decision. It was a move to ensure the stability of the reign, the realm, and the continuation of David I's policies, to provide young Malcolm IV with a guiding hand as he grew into the role as King of Scotland. While David I was still reigning, there arose a crucial necessity to strengthen the young Malcolm's position as heir apparent, especially given the turbulent politics of the age. The solution? A grand tour of the Scottish kingdom, designed to both introduce Malcolm to his future subjects and solidify the idea of continuity in governance. Showcasing the future king, the tour was instrumental in presenting Malcolm to the lords, clergy and common people. For many, this would have been their first glimpse at their new king. They travelled with a significant retinue, including Duncan, and a large army. This sent a clear message about the consolidated power and unity behind Malcolm. The tour gave the local leaders a chance to pledge their loyalty to Malcolm, ensuring a smoother transition when the time came. It also, the exact details that they visited during the tour might not be fully documented, but they likely spanned key political and religious centres. Important boroughs, monasteries and castles would have been prioritised. So, given its emerging importance, Malcolm and Duncan would have undoubtedly have made their presence felt in Edinburgh, perhaps even at the formidable Edinburgh Castle, Berwick, maybe at Dunfermline Abbey, the historical site of the Scottish coronations as well. It would have been seen for Malcolm to go to Scone. They would have also journeyed through the lowlands and highlands and possibly ventured to the Western Isles, ensuring the broadest reach of their message is there and visible. But Duncan's involvement was vital. As an experienced leader and close confidant of David, he provided a sense of continuity during the tour as well. In essence, Duncan was actually acting as David during the tour, making sure all would be subjected to Malcolm IV and would all bow to him and submit to his future rule. In summation, this grand tour, whilst orchestrated by David, was a masterful blend of politics, ceremony and strategy. It set the stage for Malcolm's reign, ensuring that when he did ascend the throne, he was no stranger to his subjects or the intricate tapestry of Scottish politics. So both David and Duncan hit a masterstroke with this tour, and it really helped the transition, as we'll see in the future episodes, go a lot more smoothly than we're used to here on the History of Scotland. But alas, David, one of Scotland's most transformative kings, met his end on May the 24th, 1153 AD. His reign, spanning almost three decades, saw Scotland undergo monumental changes in governance, religion, and infrastructure. But like every mortal, he too had to face his final moments. David I passed away in Carlisle, a city that he had a deep connection with during his lifetime, especially during his Prince of Cumbrians, if you remember back to the early reign episode. Under David, Carlisle blossomed into a major administrative centre, reflecting his vision for a new and reformed Scotland as we know. The exact details surrounding the immediate cause of David's death remain somewhat elusive in the historical records. However, given that he was around 69 years old, a venerable age for the 12th century, it's likely that natural causes or age-related health complications led to his passing. David's reign, especially in his later years, was rife with personal tragedies, including the death of his only legitimate son, Henry. These could have taken a toll on his health and spirits. While precise details of his very last moments aren't explicitly chronicled, it's plausible that David was surrounded by close members of the court, clerics, and his confidants. Given his deep piety and contributions to the church, it's almost certain that religious rites and prayers would have been a significant part of his last hours. David might have also shared some final guidance or wishes regarding the future of Scotland, especially given that his young grandson, Malcolm IV, was set to succeed him. So that's it. David took his last breath and passed into the annals of history. But Duncan took a step that puzzled many, but was deeply rooted in a political wisdom. He ensured that David's young grandson, Malcolm IV, was crowned as King of Scotland at Scone, but this was done before David was buried. Why for such urgency? Well, as we know, the power vacuum was there. Malcolm needed to be crowned immediately. It reduced the potential for rival claimants or factions to challenge his right to the throne. Malcolm IV was just a boy, only about 12 years old. The early coronation overseen by influential figures like Duncan would serve to protect him. With the official title of king, it became the duty and obligation of the Scottish nobles to rally round and protect their young monarch. Scone was not just any location, it was the traditional crowning site of Scottish monarchs. And I think what we're going to do at the start of Malcolm's reign is we're going to tell a proper telling of Scone and how the ceremony of making a king in Scotland is performed, because it isn't as simple as the English way. And I think I did mention how David came to the throne, but that isn't the correct way someone would become a Scottish king. There were some traditions that had to be followed. So we'll go over that at the start of Malcolm's reign. But regardless, as regent, Duncan would wield considerable influence during the early years of Malcolm's reign. But by facilitating this early coronation, he not only fortified Malcolm's position, but also solidified his role as a leading figure and the regent in the Scottish kingdom. David I of Scotland was buried in Dunfermline Abbey, situated in the town of Dunfermline in Fife in Scotland. Dunfermline Abbey is a significant historical and archaeological landmark and has been the final resting place for several Scottish monarchs. Yes, you can visit Dunfermline Abbey today. Beyond its significance as a burial place for David, Dunfermline Abbey is also known for its Norman architecture and as a burial site for other notable Scottish monarchs, including Robert the Bruce, and also a few other monarchs that are coming in the future that I won't spoil. The Abbey and its grounds are open to the public and it's a popular site for both tourists and locals. The visitor experience includes exploring the historic nave, the stunning architecture of the church, and the adjacent palace ruins. If you're planning a visit, it's wise to check opening hours in advance as they can vary, but it's definitely worth the trip and I really highly recommend it to visit the final resting place of David I. But you can also immerse yourself in the rich history of Scotland's most treasured landmarks. In the annals of Tiger March, which were miraculously chronicled the events of Ireland and the surrounding regions during the medieval times, David I was memorised with an epitaph that reveals much about his reign and influence. When the annals refer to David as David, son of Malcolm, King of Scotland and England, this title is significant for several reasons. The annals are emphasising David's lineage as a son of Malcolm III of Scotland, but also saying that he is not only a Scottish king that's ruled for a long time, but the Saxon part in it is especially noteworthy. While David was never the king of the England or the land of the English, which was Saxon, in the terms of how it was pronounced during the Tiger March Chronicles, it's symbolic of David's significant territories in Northern England. Throughout David's reign, he had made several territorial gains in the region as we know, especially the earldoms of Northumbria, Cumberland and Westmorland, so that the annals might be emphasising his domination over the Scottish and certain English territories. But this title unequivocally conveys a power and prestige that David held during his time. It was not merely his rule over Scotland that made him a formidable monarch, but also his territories in England, which significantly expanded the Scottish realm. This extension of the control south of the border was a pivotal moment in the history of Scotland, representing its influence and strength during David's rule. Mention in the annals of Tiger March, therefore, does not more than just mark David's death. It offers a snapshot of his legacy, highlighting the geopolitical landscape of the British Isles during the 12th century. The very fact that such an Irish chronicle took note of David's reign and its implications is a testament to his broader influence in medieval English and Scottish politics. But as we draw this episode to a close, it's imperative to reflect upon the indelible mark left by David. His reign was not merely a period of governance, it was a profound era of transformation. Through the Davidonian Revolution, through his wars, through the establishment of boroughs, the bolstering of the church, and the fortification of the Scottish territories. From Edinburgh to Berwick, his impact can still be felt, with town charters, castles, and churches bearing silent testament to his vision. A contemporary cleric during David's time remarked, "David's rule was not just about the sword and the sceptre, but about the quill and the parchment." This quote, I think, encapsulates David's approach to governance, blending martial prowess with a profound understanding of administration and diplomacy. So, that is it. That is the end of our reign on David the First. Six episodes done. Whew, that was fun. I really, really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed telling David's story. I can't wait to get started on Malcolm the Fourth next time. And I'm saying next time and not next week, because our next three episodes promise a comprehensive delve into the social fabric of 12th century Scotland. So the next week, we'll immerse you in an episode as life as a Scot in the mid-12th century. We'll explore the everyday challenges and joys from the bustling streets of the burgeoning boroughs to the tranquil clusters of the monasteries. Following that, the next episode will pan to the Scotland on the European stage, evaluating its continental relationships and diplomatic endeavours. And given the era's frequent bouts of warfare, it's only an apt that we dissect the 12th and 1st century Scottish military tactics in our third episode. But rest assured, by the end of November, after the next three episodes, we'll re-centre our tale around Malcolm the Fourth, picking up the threads of royal succession and the future of the Scottish realm. A gentle reminder that our episodes drop weekly, so do keep an ear out for our episode next week. If you wish to stay updated with snippets, historical trivia, or engaging discussions, give us a follow on Twitter at thehistoryofsc1, that is at thehistoryofsc1, or join our community on Facebook at the History of Scotland podcast. Sorry for any kind of complications, not pronouncing things properly, or sounding like I've got a blocked nose. I actually do have a blocked nose. I've got a really bad cold and flu at the moment, so that's why I was mumbling some of my words. I just wanted to get this episode done because I've been really looking forward to it. I know you guys were. We've got quite a few reviews extra on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, etc. So I don't want the growth to stall. So yeah, ramble over. I do apologise. I am ill. That's why this episode's been a bit potentially all over the place, but I'm still happy with it, and I'm hope you guys enjoyed it too. And if you've enjoyed the journey, we would appreciate a review on your preferred podcast platform. As I've mentioned, we're on 130 reviews on Spotify, which is insane, and I think we're over 40-50 Apple Podcast reviews, so it's really, really cool. Whether you're tuning in via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean, thank you for letting us be a part of your week. Till our next episode though, here's wishing you a week filled with curiosity and wonder. Stay safe, keep exploring, and goodbye for now. Peace, guys.